So there are 11 benefits to loving kindness. Who can name any of them?
Eat well.
Oh, you notice. It's the very first one given. And by the way, everyone who's sitting so meditatively with your eyes closed, it's not how I'm used to giving Dhamma talks. If that's what you need to do, okay, but I prefer interaction. Or if your eyes are hurting, please make yourself comfortable.
The deities like you.
Ah, the deities like you. What else? Yes.
Your complexion will be good.
Your complexion brightens. Becomes very nice. Three down.
Human beings like you.
Human beings like you. The devas and non-human beings are all one category, so already. Four. Ah, protection. That's multiple ones in the list.
Is fire what I want?
Hmm?
Fire?
Fire won't hurt you? What else? Fire?
If you do not gain enlightenment, you'll be born in the Brahma world.
That's right. That's usually the last one. Got six down. Two more having to do with your resting well at night. Sleep well, wake up well.
Yeah.
No bedrooms.
No nightmares. Yeah. Right? We're up to eight.
Weapons don't harm.
Weapons don't harm. There's one more in that line of thought.
Animals
no? We already covered that one.
Poison.
Poison?
Poison is not.
There's one more. What is it?
Poison.
No, let me think. Okay. Sleep well, get up well, do not have nightmares. One becomes dear to human beings, dear to non-human beings.
You can concentrate easily.
Is that the one? Okay. Hold that thought. I have to count them now. Fire, weapon, poisons do not hurt one. The complexion brightens. It's another one we've said.
One gets reborn in the Brahma.
Yeah, one dies without confusion is one we hadn't said. Now we've lost one of the ones that we said.
We haven't said die without confusion.
I just added that one.
Yeah.
Well, I think we've covered all 11 anyway, I'm sure. Okay, there was an occasion, according to the story, and I want you to suspend disbelief. There are these stories that come down to us in the tradition that are highly useful. They serve a purpose. I wouldn't be interested in them. Actually, I would be interested in them for the entertainment value. I wouldn't teach them just for the entertainment value. But these stories can lodge in our imagination in a way that the straight teachings don't always do. They can. Okay, last photo. Yeah. All right, now put it away. Okay. The stories can get into our imagination and actually inform our conduct in a way that the intellect cannot quite do. There's a way that the stories catch our emotion, catch our sensitivity to what is morally acceptable, to what it is we really want to be doing in this life. The imagination can bring the story to mind right when we're in some sort of ethical dilemma, or right when we're at a juncture where we're trying to decide how to hold something, how to handle things in the world. So here's a beautiful story to inform our understanding of how to be in this world. And this is the story that triggered the Buddha, triggered the Buddha to say the Dhammapada verse. Nahi vegrena vegrani sammanti dakudachanam avegrena ca sammanti esa dhamma sanantano. Hatreds never cease through hatred in this world. Through love alone they cease. This is an eternal law. We've probably heard that many, many times. It's quoted even by people who don't know anything else about Buddhism, they know that, quote, hatred is never overcome by hatred, it's overcome by love alone. Here's the story that can really catch our imagination and bring it to life when needed. There was a woman married to a man, and long ago ancient times, back actually around the time of the Buddha. They cohabited for some period of time as husband and wife. No child came. Now, if no child happens within a year of normal relations, that's considered barren. More and more time went by, and the woman realized that her position was quite precarious. If he took another wife who had children, she would not be number one wife. She would be nobody. So grasping after any little bit of security she could get, she went to her husband herself and said, "Dear, it doesn't look like I'm going to continue the lineage of your family. Take another wife." He said, no, I care about you. She said, "No, let me choose her. That's all I ask." And the husband was delighted that she was proposing a solution that would bring harmony to the household instead of, you know, bitter situation between co-wives. He readily agreed to that. So she went out searching for a very malleable, innocent girl and found one very easily and brought her home and treated her like her own daughter or her own little sister. And very soon this girl was pregnant. And quickly she reported it to her older wife, and the older wife made every sign of expressing joy at the, you know, expected arrival. And slipped to her an abortifacient, slipped her poison that caused her to have an abortion. And the girl was quite innocent, would never have imagined such evil from her dear friend. And they mourned the loss, and a little time went by, and this bountiful girl was pregnant again. And again she reported it to her elder wife, again the elder wife got rid of it. Third time, the young woman became pregnant. And this time she didn't get around to mentioning it to her elder wife. Well, she was leaning against the property fence, chatting with the neighbor, and said, "Oh, I've lost the first one, I lost the second one, now I've got the third one. I so hope I don't lose this one." And the neighbor was a little more sharp in the ways of the world and said, "Well, did your elder wife know about these other pregnancies?" "Well, yeah, of course." "She know about this one yet?" No, and I'm almost coming to term, you know, I'm starting to show on it, I think, but this one's getting a lot further along." And the neighbor said, "Perhaps your co-wife is poisoning you. Be careful." She was stunned, absolutely stunned. So she didn't tell the co-wife. And soon, of course, the co-wife notices, "Oh, you're starting to show." And the girl said, "You stay away from me." So the girl was very, very careful about what she ate, what she drank. But eventually, someone with an evil intention, who's living right there with her, and she managed to get the poison to her. But at this point, it was very far along in the pregnancy. And this miscarriage that was triggered was a deadly one. The girl suffered terribly as she was miscarrying this child, and it ended up killing her. This labor, this poison-induced labor, was her deathbed. And as she was in agony, losing her child, losing her life, she swore on her deathbed revenge. She took the hatred, the terrible betrayal, the evil deeds done to her, and she turned it into a mission to return harm for harm. She vowed that in a future life she would do the same thing to her enemy, the co-wife who had so victimized her, this innocent girl. And so the enmity began. In the next life, and here's where you have to suspend your disbelief, but it's a very useful story. In the next life, they were a cat and a chicken. The former victim was now the predator. The former predator was now the innocent chicken. The innocent chicken's little chicks. First one was grabbed by the evil cat. Second one grabbed by the evil cat. Third one grabbed and the chicken itself killed. I forgot to mention, when the husband learned what had happened, he beat his elder wife to death. So the wives had deaths of similar timing. Well, the chicken is dead. The cat some point dies. They have a number of lives together, being victim, being predators, back and forth, back and forth. At one point, there are deer and tiger, and the baby deers, the little fawns get killed, and eventually the deer gets killed, and it just goes back and forth. And finally, they are reborn as a noble woman and an ogress, a yakka. So it's like a human being, looks like a human being, but has superpowers and feeds on dead human flesh. Or can feed on dead human flesh, but very powerful, physically very powerful being with certain psychic abilities. Yakini would be the technical term in Pali. So the former predator, I believe, is the Yakini. And the other one is a noble woman, and she marries a nice man, and they happily start their family. And when the first baby is born, as the guests are admiring the child, the ogress slips in, the Yakini slips in, looking human enough, and picks up the baby and bites a fatal wound into it, eats some or all of the baby and runs away. Well, the people are screaming in horror. So they get over it. Eventually they have another child, and the Yakini actually manages to do the same thing. When they're pregnant, when the pregnancy comes for a third child, they leave their home and go stay with her parents for safety. So they actually deliver safely. Meanwhile, the Yakini was distracted with other things, and she comes back and goes looking for her enemy. She doesn't have conscious awareness that this woman that she's stalking is an old enemy from a past life. She just sees her and hates her. You ever had anybody like that in your life? You see him and you just hate him on sight? Or someone in your life, you see him and you just love them on sight? Or somebody who looks right at you and says, "I really hate you," or thinks it clearly, or is just out to get you for no reason that you can see? One time I was walking down the street in New York City. I was in law school then, and at the school there, and a crazy woman, very thin, came up to me with her hands and fists and yelled at me that I had killed her husband and her children. I'm like, oh my God, it's a crazy woman. I mean, you know, they can have kind of extra powers when they're really truly mad. And I ran into the dormitory, and the guy I was dating stood at the door and kept her away from me at the door, and she ranted and railed at the door for a while and eventually went away. It was very scary. And if that were to happen to me now, I would say, I'm so sorry. I didn't know what I was doing. You're right. I mean, who knows? Maybe she had more insight into things than me. At the time, I thought, I'm innocent. I never killed anybody. But in these long rounds of samsara, surely we've killed each other's loved ones and other horrible deeds. So the husband and wife carrying the baby are coming home from her parents, thinking they've escaped that horrible monster that's been killing their children. They stopped off at a public bathing water tank, and the wife bathed and refreshed the child, and is standing there nursing the child while the husband bathes. The Yakini had come home, looked around for her enemy, made inquiries, and went off stalking her victim towards the town where they were staying. So they collide there at the water tank. The woman looks up and sees the monstrous woman coming at her with murder in her eyes, and screams and runs, just runs. The husband is in the water tank. He can't collect himself to defend her. And the Yakini is hot in pursuit. Well, the water tank was near a monastery, and she runs right into the congregation where the Buddha is teaching, runs right into the place where he's giving the teaching, and deities stop her. The Yakini is stopped at the gate, the door, the woman runs in through the crowd, runs right up to the Buddha, completely interrupting everything with her extreme drama, puts the baby at his feet, and says, "Save my baby, save my baby." And the Yakini is out there stopped by the Deva guards, and is trying to see what's going on. When the woman is calmed down, the Buddha gave the order that the Yakini come in quietly. So the Yakini, you know, all the heat of the chase is subdued, and she walks in and stands in front of the Buddha. And the Buddha scolded them, "You are very lucky that you have come into the presence of an enlightened Buddha. You have been doing this to each other lifetime after lifetime. It would have gone on indefinitely." And he told the whole story of how this began and how they had been torturing each other lifetime after lifetime after lifetime. No end in sight. But now they had come in front of a Buddha, and he could explain it all to them. And he explained it all and gave them this understanding that their hatred would continue to fuel itself indefinitely. You do not put out a fire by throwing kerosene on it. You don't stop a war by killing the people more effectively. You don't stop a feud by getting in the last word, the last hit, the last injury, the last win. Hatred is only overcome by loving kindness. So he explained this basic truth, universal truth, endless truth. It's just the way it is. So he gave them the understanding they needed to put an end to their feud, or it would just continue. Then he gave the woman a challenge, the noble woman. He said to her, "Hand your baby over to the Yakini." She said, "Lord, Lord, my baby." And he said, "She's safe now." Because while she was receiving this teaching, the Yakini went to a first stage of enlightenment. It can actually happen with these beings. Yakas and Yakinis tend towards evil, but they can hear the Dhamma and understand. And he persuaded her. Perhaps only a Buddha could have persuaded her. And with great fear and reluctance, she handed that baby over to that beastly woman who had killed two of her children. And the Yakini cradled the baby, kissed it, and handed it back. So then there was trust established. Yakini started crying, and the Buddha said, "Why are you crying?" She said, "I've been living on human bodies in the cemetery. I can't live like that now that I've seen the noble truth. What am I going to do?" And the Buddha said to the noble woman, "Take care of her." She agreed. And they went home together. So the noble woman and her husband fixed up a house for the Yakini on their property and took care of her. Whatever meal that they would prepare, they would give the first part, the best part, first to the Yakini. They honored her in every way. The Yakini, for her part, had psychic powers. And one thing that she knew was weather. So she would know things like whether it's going to be raining like this, on and on and on, and she would know what kind of crops to plant in accordance to what kind of weather was going to be happening. Well, if a farmer knows what to plant in accordance with what weather is coming, that's an extraordinary bit of information. And they were fabulously successful, and so were all their neighbors, because they didn't hold the information to themselves. They shared the information with everyone in the region, and the whole region was wonderfully prosperous, thanks to the loving kindness that had been established between these two past enemies. I have another story for you. In great contrast, there was an extraordinarily poor man, a sharecropper named Puna, who worked for a very wealthy man named Sumana. And a festival day came, and everyone's going to be out partying. But Puna approaches the master of the estate, Sumana, and says, "Can I have the good oxen today and the good plow? I'm going to be working while everyone else is partying." And the master said, "Are you sure? You sure you want to be working?" He says, "Look, we don't even have enough for tomorrow's meal. Yeah, we've got to work." And he said, "Okay, well, all the best to you. Take the good stuff. Take the good oxen and plow." So Puna goes out there and he's working hard. He said to his wife, "Well, we can't celebrate the festival, but Would you fix me a double portion of for the meal today? At least let me have that much. So she agreed. So she's home cooking the meal, and he's plowing, working hard. That morning, though, Venerable Sariputta, the general of the Dhamma, the number one in wisdom of all the monks, had just spent 7 days in the bliss of enjoying Nirodha Sampatti. And he came out of this special bliss of enjoying Nibbana, and after 7 days of this meditation, and looked around with his psychic eye of who could he really help by allowing them the merit of giving him the first meal after coming out of a 7-day meditation. And he thought about that poor fellow Puna. Puna, be willing to do that. Could really benefit. He's really so extremely poor and devout. He went to where Puna was plowing and stood nearby, looking down at a bush, and Puna got the idea he was looking for a toothstick, so he broke off a toothstick and made it nicely for him. Then Sariputta brought out his cup and water strainer, and Sariputta fetched him water and strained it and gave it to him nicely. And Venerable Sariputta felt it was confirmed that Puna would be very devout and would benefit. So he went to place himself at a position where Puna's wife would see him and give him the meal. And he knew if he walked all the way to the house that the food wouldn't be ready and it just wouldn't work out. So he actually just stood around for a period of time outside of Puna's sight, waiting for the right time, and then walked down the road very casually, just as Puna's wife was coming around the corner. And seeing Venerable Sariputta, she was amazed. She thought, oh, so many times it happens, you see the great ones, and you've got no food on hand. You've got nothing to give. And there are times when you have something to give, and the great ones are nowhere to be seen, but today there's something to be given, and there's a great one. Yes! And so she went up to Venerable Sariputta, set down the container of food on the ground, and bowed all the way down with the 5-point prostration, and said, oh, Venerable Sir, please accept this food out of compassion for me. And he accepted, but when half the food was in his bowl, he covered the bowl with his hand, and she said, don't have sympathy for me in this life. Have sympathy for me for the next life. Please take it all. And so he received all of the food, and she said, by the power of this merit, may I have the understanding you have. May I see what you've seen. And he said, so be it. And then he went off and ate the food. And she ran home and, is really scrounging now for something to cook, but she put something together. And Puna, he's overcome with heat at midday. He's so hungry. He's waiting. And the wife finally comes around the corner with the food, and she thinks, he's waiting. He gets mad at me. He's not going to share in this merit. So as she approached him, she said, dear, don't be angry. The general of the Dhamma received your food. Please don't be angry. And he said, what? And she explained the whole thing. He said, you know, wife, I myself also gave him a toothstick and water. I rejoice with you. And they were both so happy. And he ate the meal. And he's so tired because of having gotten way too hungry. And he puts his head down in her lap and goes to sleep. So they take a little nap. And when he wakes up, what does he see? That flounder looked gold. And here too. Can it be? It's covered in gold. Everywhere he looks, there's gold. He said, I can't hide this. I better get the, make a connection with the king. So he puts all this, a bunch of gold into the bowl his wife had brought his food in, and he goes straight to the king. He says, Your Highness, this is for you. And the king said, well, where did this come from? He explained, my field is full of gold. The king said, what do you want me to do? And Puna said, bring hundreds of carts. Carted away. It's yours, Your Highness. And King said, okay. Sent hundreds of carts. They filled thousands of carts. And when the men were taking up the gold, and they said, this is for the king. And suddenly there was no gold. It was all mud. Mm-hmm. Said, what happened? And they sent word to the king. The king said, what did you say? They said what they said. We said this is for the king. He says, oh, go back and say it's for Puna. And they did. This is for Puna. It's all gold again. So thousands of carts of gold. And they're all hauled to the king. And the king said, Puna, you're a wealthy man now. And Puna said, may I have a nice place to build a home? And the king gave him a nice place and named him one of the treasurers of the city. They didn't have banks in those days. The wealthy men would be the treasurers. So the merchant he used to work for, Sumana, he was one of the great treasurers. And now Puna is also one of the great treasurers of the city. Now, Puna, in his poverty, had just himself, his wife, and his daughter. His daughter's name is Uttara. She was 7 years old when all this happened. When Puna had his opening of his house, he had a great celebration, and he invited the Buddha and his monks and had 7 days of celebrations and giving of Dhamma to the Buddha and his monks. And the little 7-year-old girl heard the Dhamma talks every day. And at the end of the week, the little 7-year-old Uttara was established in the fruition of stream entry. She's a Sotapanna, first stage of enlightenment. So she's enlightened, but she's also a normal kid in many ways. And she grew up to become a beautiful, wonderfully loving, open-hearted, beautiful girl. And the guys wanted her. And Sumana, Puna's former benefactor, his former employer, wanted her in his family. So he did great honor to Puna, recognizing him as an equal, saying, give your daughter to my son. And Puna said, no. What? No. Your family are unbelievers. I'm sorry, my daughter is absolutely devoted to the Buddha and Dhamma and Sangha. It wouldn't work. Well, the other treasurer was actually deeply offended, and the word got around. So all the other treasurers of the land came to Puna one by one and said, you've got to do this. You cannot break with your former benefactor. This is ugly. You can't not give your daughter, act like she's not good enough. So with great reluctance, Puna gave his daughter, Uttara, into Sumana's family. And some time went by, and she sent a message to her father, you put me in prison. Why didn't you just make me a slave? All this time, I haven't had one opportunity to observe the Uposatha, not one opportunity to give alms to the monks and nuns. I'm miserable. It broke Puna's heart that she's in this position now. So he came up with a plan, a very unusual plan. Not the kind of thing you would expect. He sent her 15,000 gold coins and suggested a course of action, which she did. She contacted the courtesan of her hometown, her home city. Courtesan's name was Sirima. Sirima was like a supermodel, no ordinary courtesan. She was somebody that the kings were fighting over. Sirima favors me. She commanded 1,000 gold coins a night for her services. She was a master of dance and song and all the arts of a courtesan. And she was proud, and she was drop-dead gorgeous, absolutely gorgeous. I imagine her being the kind of woman who could, put a peacock feather in her hair and carry it off, multiple peacock feathers in her hair. She was extraordinary. She made the agreement with Uttara to come and be the wife for 2 weeks, 1,000 a night, well, a fortnight, 15 days, so that Uttara could get permission to be completely free to serve the Buddha and his monks for the 2 weeks. These are the last 2 weeks of the Vasa. So from the half moon until the end of the Vasa, to the time of the Pavarana, she wanted to be able to serve the Buddha and his monks. And the Buddha very compassionately agreed to come to her house every day those last 2 weeks of the Vasa. So, only thing now is to get the permission of the husband. She's got it all set up. She brings this extraordinary woman to the house, introduces her to her husband, and says, dear, this lady could replace me for the next 2 weeks. If I could be free to keep the precepts and serve the Buddha and his monks for these 2 weeks, would you agree to that, please, sir? And he looks at this incredible supermodel and lust arises and he says, oh, yes. He completely agrees to it. Sirima set about to become the best wife. She's the best courtesan. Now, I'm reading into the story here a bit, but I imagine with her pride, with her ego, she would want to be the best wife. She gets to serve the in-laws. She's running household. She didn't get to do stuff like this. She's a courtesan. Different customers night by night. Now she's settled into a house for 2 weeks, serving the in-laws, running the place, doing everything. It's her role, and she's really playing it to the hilt. Meanwhile, Uttara is there in the kitchen with the maids, with her own hands cooking the food for the Buddha and hundreds of monks. She is in heaven. She's covered in ghee and flour and charcoal and grit and absolutely joyful to get to serve the Buddha. She has perfect confidence. Remember, this is part of what is a Sotapanna, someone who has no doubt. She has perfect confidence in the Buddha, in his teachings, and in the enlightened Sangha. So the joy she has in this kind of giving is just unparalleled. Full of love, full of happiness, she's doing this work. And the 2 weeks fly by. And then just before the last day, the husband looks in the window, into the lattice work, into the kitchen, and sees her in that state, covered in flour and so forth. And he smirks, thinking, what an idiot. Here she is, a wealthy woman, born poor, wealthy woman. She has no idea how to enjoy her wealth. She thinks serving that shaveling is a good thing to do. And he's just full of scorn, and he just laughs at her. And the stories differ among the different commentaries, but one of the commentaries says that she sees him and thinks he has so much wealth and he has no idea what is true joy, and she also smiles. Anyway, whether or not she smiles, Sirima saw at least the husband laughing. Whether or not she saw both of them, I'm not sure, but she saw the husband smirk. Now, I saw a study recently where meditators were given photographs of people expressing having different emotional states, and people who had meditated a lot were more able to accurately identify what mental states were going with what facial expressions. Sirima was clueless. She's a woman with many desires, much pride, many defilements. She hasn't a clue. She sees the man's face in the mouth twisted up in a smile, and she mistakes his disdain for an intimate moment between him and his wife. Problem is, she's playing wife. She forgot that she's the outsider in a paid position. She was really playing her role. And her time as wife is not yet over. It burned into her pride. She actually flew into a rage that those two were having what she perceived as an intimate moment through the window, when she, the courtesan, Sirima, is the wife at that time. And she thought, well, I'm going to put the hurt on her. And she rushed into the kitchen and grabbed a ladle full of boiling ghee. Ghee is clarified butter. It's butter with the fat solids removed. It boils at a hotter temperature. This is worse than boiling water. It's worse than ordinary boiling oil. This is boiling ghee. A ladle of it. And goes at Uttara. Now when Sirima saw Uttara come into the kitchen, the first thought that came into her mind was not jealousy, not any kind of negativity, but my benefactor. My benefactress who has allowed me to serve the Buddha and the monks for these 2 weeks. And she's just feeling love and joy at the sight of this courtesan. And then when it's clear the courtesan is about to kill her, they don't have, high-tech burn centers. Sirima grabs his ladle of oil and tips it over the head of Sirima, her head, her face. What will boiling oil do to a human being's skin? This is an act of attempted murder. She's heading, going at her with this boiling oil. When that hits somebody's head, when it hits their face is gone. It's gone. There's no recovering from that. It's a horrible mortal wound. But remember, this is no ordinary person. She's a noble being, known for her loving kindness. Her mindfulness is very good, very swift. And as that oil came towards her, she had just enough time to have the thought that this is my good friend. If I have any hatred towards her, even an iota of hatred, even the smallest bit of hatred towards her, let this boiling oil sear me. But if not, if I have only love for her, if not, let it roll off of me like water. So what do you think happened as this woman, filled with powerful metta, faced the enemy, throwing the oil in her face? Fire, weapons, poison cannot hurt. Now, someone who has a strong metta practice, who does not in that moment project the metta, still can be hurt. But in that moment of radiating powerful metta, according to the Buddha, can't be hurt. Not by those things, cannot. The oil just rolled off of her like water. So Sirima was confused, thinking maybe it wasn't really boiling. She went back to another pot to get really boiling oil. And at this point, the ladies in the kitchen are aware that this outsider is attempting to murder their loving, wonderful mistress. So there's two things going on there. There's the pride that this outsider is attacking their lady. Two, you know, this is a wonderful woman that this courtesan is attacking. So, it's being recorded, so you can catch the end line.
So the bystanders were
yes. They fell on Sirima, kicking her, punching her, threw her down to the floor and kicked her more. Sirima tried to Uttara tried to stop them. Don't hurt her, don't hurt her. Now do you think the kitchen ladies are gonna not try to hurt the courtesan that just tried to kill their lady? They're not listening. You're too nice. Just not listening to you. And they're just punching and kicking. Sirima, Uttara, the wife, had to actually block with her own body. She had to cover Sirima with her own body to get the kitchen ladies to back off. So there's this awful moment of silence. And Sirima suddenly realizes she is an outsider. Over not what should be a provocation, she has attempted murder. That the ladies who are, that Uttara was so good she did not tell the ladies to seize her. In fact, she tried to call them off. In fact, she ended up holding them off of her with her own body. Meanwhile, Uttara sends the ladies off to get various kinds of healing oils and ointments. And with warm water, she helps Sirima up to a sitting position and bathes the wounds and puts the healing oils on her and says to her, why did you do this evil thing? And, by now, Sirima's head is completely cleared. Anger is like that. Anger is very fickle. It's like an unreliable lover. It comes to you and gives you all these promises of power and the good stuff that's going to happen from your acting on the power you feel with the anger. And then it disappears and you're all by yourself. Like a bad man whispering sweet nothings in the night, and in the morning the girl is by herself, having to face all the consequences. Sirima, her head is cleared, realizes there are consequences. As soon as she can, she gets up and bows all the way down to the ground. She probably never in her life has done to anyone, bows all the way down to the ground in front of the wife. and begs forgiveness for what she has done. And the wife, again, full of love and sympathy, full of compassion, with a quick mind, says, oh, this is a big thing that's happened. I will forgive you if my father forgives you. And Sirima says, you'll forgive me if Guna, the banker, the treasurer, forgives me. And she says, oh, no, that's my father in the realms of samsara. But my father in spiritual insight, my father in liberation, the Buddha, liberation from samsara, the end of samsara. If my father, the Buddha, forgives you, I will forgive you. And Sirima says, I don't know him. What should I do? And and the wife said, come when he'll come tomorrow with his monks. You come in and we'll talk with him. And Kodesham said, please, I want to make the meal. I'll make the meal myself. I'll go to my home and do that. You serve it. I'm too ashamed, but I'll make the meal. And the wife agreed. So Sirima hurried home to her own palace. She was a very wealthy woman, very successful woman, and rounded up all of her servants, and they did a massive feast, cooking in the night. And many, many cartloads of food were trundled over from Sirima's home over to Uttara's home there in the other town. Word got out of what happened. Can you imagine? Could not keep something like that secret. All the kitchen people saw the miracle. The miracle. Boiling oil, not killing her. And everyone knew the drama that was unfolding. This was big. This would have been carried by every tabloid if they had, this would be on the news if they had news in the way that we do today. Just imagine if one of the greatest supermodels of the land. Who are the great supermodels that people speak of these days? I live in a monastery. I wouldn't know. That's old school. Come on, I know that now. Who? Jolene? She's too nice to play this role.
Miranda
Kerr. Are there any bad-tempered ones? Naomi Campbell, that's right. She hit one of her employees with a telephone. She'd been arrested more than once for her bad behavior. Perfect. Just imagine Naomi coming. She's gorgeous. Absolutely gorgeous. So imagine a gorgeous woman with a really bad temper. And a big, big amount of pride. Okay, so Naomi has gone home to... could I get sued for this? Well, anyway. She has gone home to prepare the meal. She brings it. She kind of hides herself away during all of this. Oh, here's what I was saying. Imagine Naomi Campbell has tried to kill Bill Gates' daughter, a billionaire's daughter. This would be big. This would be very big. You're not going to sweep it under the carpet. You can't just walk away and pretend nothing happened. And you do not want to fall under the into the tender hands of the king. When you've done an evil deed and people feel like the king could have, power over you, the kings, they often start with cutting off the nose and begin the tortures from there. She's in big danger, serious danger. Her pride is broken. She's wide open and she's having an audience with the Buddha. This is good. So you can imagine everybody who could be there would be there. So you've got the hundreds of monks, you have the Buddha, you have the entire family, the entire serving staff, and every single neighbor and important person who could squeeze themselves into that space. I don't know if it's a big open hall or what, but everybody who couldn't be there is going to be there. And then the drama unfolds. The Buddha has finished his meal. Buddha takes his hand from the bowl. The bowl is taken away and washed. And now it's time. So Uttara approaches the Buddha, and Sirima comes running in and throws herself on the ground in front of the Buddha and says, please forgive me, please forgive me. He says, for what should I forgive you, Sirima? And she says, forgive me for attempting to harm Uttara. I came at her with boiling oil and threw it onto her. And the Buddha said, Uttara, is this true? And she said, yes, Lord. And she described the whole thing. And the Buddha said, Uttara, what was in your mind when that boiling well came at you? And she said, Lord, I thought, this is my good friend who has helped me to serve the Lord Buddha and the monks. If I have an iota of anger towards her, let this boiling oil sear me. If I have an iota of hate, let this boiling oil sear me. But if I have only love, let it roll off of me like water. And the Buddha said, well done, Uttara, well done. Sadhu, sadhu, he said. And then he stated,
Akkadhena jine khadham, asadhum sadhuna jine, jine kadariyandanena sachena alikavadinam. Conquer anger by love, evil by good. Conquer the miser with liberality and the liar with truth. Conquer anger by love, conquer evil by good. Conquer the miser with liberality and conquer the liar, one who tells lies, with truth. That's Dhammapada number 223.
And then he gave a Dhamma talk. At the end of all this, Uttara was in the third stage of enlightenment. No, Sakadagami, second stage of enlightenment. Her husband was established as a Sotapanna, and so were his parents. And Sirima also attained the first stage of enlightenment. I want to draw a contrast in these two stories about, and many beings benefited. So I want to draw out the contrast in the two stories. A young woman who did not have the benefit of the Dhamma, did not have the benefit of mental training, was faced with an extraordinary cruelty. And her response was to vow vengeance on her deathbed. And the hatred continued, and the negativity continued, and beings suffered loss. There were beings that also suffered in all of this predation that was going on. The two themselves and all the ones who would care about them. Perhaps the animal lives, not so much, but in some of the animal lives, definitely. And certainly with the children. This kind of hatred can go on, and the circle of pain just grows and grows. And the other case, a woman who had done no wrong was about to be victimized by a woman who wrongheadedly had gone on the basis of her pride and her confusion, her delusion, had gone into this state of rage and was going to kill her, and responded not with deathbed hate, not with aversion, not even with fear, but with a boldness born of loving kindness. And look how many beings benefited. Just think of the tragedy of this lovely woman. If she had had a moment of hate as that boil hit her, or non-powerful metta, just ordinary, she just hadn't even seen it coming, say, she would have died a horrible death. Sotapanna or not, it would have been a horrible death, very painful. And all of her loved ones would have been mourning for her, this wonderful lady dying a horrible, unjustified death. Sirima, the courtesan, would have probably been tortured to death. She also would have suffered horribly. All those associated with her would have gone down in some way. They would have suffered. Misery would have compounded upon misery. There would have been so much hate, so much grief, so much confusion. So much was averted by an instant of very quick loving kindness. years ago, as a laywoman, I was living in a household. I interviewed with two of the housemates, but the third didn't want to interview with me because she was moving out. I went specially to interview with her, and she breezed through the room saying, I don't have time for this, and left. Didn't interview with me. But they said, she's moving, don't worry about her. So I moved in. She didn't leave. She changed her mind. And she wouldn't give me a shelf in the bathroom, our shared bathroom on the top floor, because she just didn't feel like it. She told me I could have a shelf down the hall. And I had a cat that was old and loud, and she agitated with my roommates that the cat should have to go. I ended up having to give away the cat, and we weren't getting along. Things were not going well. She was so mean to me that one time a woman came and stayed overnight visiting her friend, this woman. Her name was Isis. This lady came visiting Isis and actually went up to me and apologized to me, saying, "I don't know why Isis is treating you so bad. I've never seen her act like this." It was horrible. And I really resented this tall, super thin, super blonde, long-haired woman with attitude who had the nerve to name herself after a god. I mean, come on. And she was into, you know, Hindu stuff, and she was would wear white clothes, and just, to me, held herself up as being holier and better. And she was into going around doing drumming, and she would go and do drumming in Hawaii, and she pronounced it Hawaii. And I hated her and her Hawaii and her drumming and her white clothes and her holiness and her hate. I hated her. It got so bad that just hearing her footsteps coming in the room, my stomach would clench. And at that time, I was keeping 8 precepts in the house. I kept 8 precepts for 6 months. And in the mornings, I would be preparing my lunch, and I was really very much engaged in the kitchen, making my entire meal for the day and sitting down to eat. And she would come downstairs talking loudly on her cell phone and take up the space, because the living room, kitchen, dining room were all one big room. It was so awful. And it just went on and on. And my hatred was killing me. And I started doing well-wishing, trying to overcome my hatred. May she be well, may she be peaceful, may she be happy. Oh, I hate her. It just went on. So, okay, may she get everything I want. I'm starting thinking of everything I want. May she be popular, may she be loved, may she this, that, and the other. I'm really trying. I'm really, really trying. And, you know, now, meanwhile, we're having more interactions, like she's mocking me because I think the door should be locked at night because she has no fear because of her religious faith. I hate her. I got desperate because my hatred for her was choking all the goodness out of me. It was making me sick physically. I needed to get over this hatred. And I thought, finally, may she get enlightened before I do. That was the one thing. That was really it. I really meant it, and I prayed it. I wished it. May she get enlightened before I do. I meant it with the core of my being. May she be well and peaceful and happy and popular and have everything she needs and all her needs met. May she be enlightened before I get enlightened. Within 12 or 24 hours of that wish, I don't remember exactly now, she walked up to me and she said, "You know, I've really been angry with you, but because I've been feeling terrible ever since you moved in, but I realized that actually what happened is that my soulmate had a motorcycle accident. We're very, very connected, and he has been really in life and death, hanging in there, trying to survive with horrible injuries for these weeks since you moved in. And actually, it has nothing to do with you. It was just this other thing going on with me. And I actually don't hate you." And I looked at her. I said, "You want me to be happy or something?" I said, "You've been pushing me out ever since I got here. I'm really hurt." And she said, "Oh, you're right." And then we started talking. We went for a long walk, and we talked, and we discovered that we had a lot in common. And we became not just friends. We became great friends. And I had a dream about her guru, and she said, "You can't have a dream about my guru unless my guru is allowing you to. Come meet my guru." And I met her guru, and I loved her guru. Her guru was awesome. Amichi, the hugging guru. I got hugged. It was wonderful. And then she moved. She moved to Hawaii. I didn't want her to move. I was in tears. I'm like, "Don't go." I didn't want her to move. Back when I was living in Greenville, South Carolina, there was a woman across the street or down the road from me who had a daughter living in a violent city, Detroit. And she told me one day that her daughter had gotten shot. Oh my God, what happened? Well, her daughter's husband had back pain, and he got into painkillers, and then he started abusing them. Then he went on to hard drugs. This is not an uncommon story, I'm afraid. From back pain to painkillers to hard drugs. I've heard it before. And then to support his habit, he started dealing drugs. And then he became more and more of a difficult, bad person under the influence of the drugs. And the daughter was having a very difficult time with her crazy drug addict, dealer husband. And then he cheated some very dangerous people in Detroit. And they decided to kill him. So he and she were in the car, and they were stopped at a stoplight. And the dangerous people he had cheated of money, somebody they'd sent to kill him, just came right up to him at the stoplight, leaned into the passenger window right there, and shot the husband as he's there in the driver's seat, shot him right through the heart, and shot the daughter 5 times. And the husband died immediately. His body stiffened, foot went down on the accelerator. The car accelerated into the intersection and crashed. And I'm like, oh, is she alive? Oh, yeah. She's really bruised. I said, bruised? She said, oh, yeah, very, very bruised. 5 really big bruises, one on her neck, one on her thigh, one on her side. Bruised? The assassin was standing right at the passenger window. She's bruised? These are real bullets that killed the husband. What's up with that? And then I said to my neighbor, is your daughter a particularly loving person? She said, oh, yes, she is the most loving person. You can't imagine. My daughter is incredibly loving. She's really special. I said, oh, really? Oh, interesting. I said, and what do you make of it? Oh, God has a plan for my daughter. I said, okay. And she informed me, too, that somebody had told her daughter that her daughter's a prophet or, you know. Okay, people build up these stories around it, but I heard what I needed to hear to make sense of it. The daughter is an incredibly loving person. Fire, weapon, poisons. So the question I have now is, what is one's intention? What is your intention? What is my intention? Next time there's a really big challenge. Someone has done evil. Am I going to improve the situation with hate? Do I imagine that hate is going to improve the situation? Do I imagine that striking back, striking a little more viciously, striking harder, is going to teach those other people a lesson, and it's not going to continue this hate? We're going to get in the last missile, the last bullet. We're going to get in the last hit, the last act of ill will. We're going to get in the last bit of slander. We're going to get in the last word. Because we're right and they're wrong. Is that the way it's going to work next time you're challenged by someone who does evil? Or are you going to think, hatred is not overcome with hatred, but with loving kindness, amazing things can happen. And things can turn around, and you just don't know what may happen. I heard about a story, I wish I knew the details now, but I heard a story years ago. A man was robbing a bank, and he took all the people hostage. And one of the hostages matched her breathing to his breathing and then slowed her breathing, and he slowed his breathing, and eventually they got out of the whole thing. It's amazing what happens when we have an open heart to another human being. Just amazing. A man attacked me once in New York City when I was a law student there. Have I told you that story yet? I told you that. The upshot is that he was a kid on drugs, maybe 15, 16, I don't know how old. And as he kept coming at me saying he could kill me, this drama went on for a little bit, and finally I just, with love in my heart, asked him if he'd eaten. And he said no, and all the fight went out of him. I took him to a diner next door and fed him. We parted as friends. You just don't know what might happen when you open your heart and allow love to be in the situation. The more we cultivate this love, the more likely it is it'll come to mind when we really need it. Open doorknobs with love. Open a window with love. Step foot out of your house with love. Spread out your sitting cloth with love. light a candle with love, prepare a meal with love, offer the food with love, receive the food with love, step carefully, gingerly through the woods with love at every step, not wanting to hurt any little being. You feel so bold, you go right up on top of a boulder and just don't even have any fear. Because you have this love. Sometimes you might even be a little silly and go right to the edge of the cliff with all this love in your heart. There was a woman in my home monastery who visited a retreat center where there were some bees caught in a bee trap. It was a thing that would lure them in with a sweet smell, and it had apple juice down in it, and they would fall in the juice and drown. And she just couldn't bear it, and she released the bees. They were yellow jackets. You got yellow jackets in Australia? It's a very small bee with a yellow coloring that can sting more than once and is very agile and can be a little bit aggressive. People get into trouble with yellow jackets when they're drinking soda drinks and having anything sweet. They're drawn to it. They might get down in the soda. You're drinking, oh, there's a yellow jacket on your lip, and you really regret it. sometimes they swarm around you, and you can get into a big mess with it. Well, there was a woman who released these yellow jackets, and she was scared doing it, but she just couldn't bear what was happening. She just broke open the thing and released them. And many, many yellow jackets were saved. And then she had like this totally tender feeling towards yellow jackets, like a mother towards her child. She loved yellow jacket bees, fearless. And then yellow jackets established a nest right under the doorway. Like there was this space about, how much is that? Is that about 6 centimeters? What would that be? 10 centimeters?
2 centimeters.
Huh? Two?
Like
millimeter. Okay.
2 millimeters.
2 millimeters. 12 millimeters. Thank you. 12 millimeters. Okay. So there's space about 12 millimeters between the base of the door and the floor right below it, and and the porch, and the bees were established right there in the middle, and anybody trying to go in and out that door got stung. So they put up some yellow caution tape there not to go through before they could smoke them out and get them to go away. But the lady who loved the yellow jackets, she went back and forth through that yellow tape fearlessly. Now, other people had to go way down a hallway and way back around. That door was very convenient between the main building and the office. Everybody else was having to go all the way around, long distance. And she just fearlessly... We go back and forth, because of her love. And here's what she said the key was. She had so much love and respect for the yellow jackets that when yellow jacket would come up and go right in front of her and confront her, she would back up. And it would go forward and she would back up, because she had respect on the basis of her love. And so when the yellow jacket saw that she was amenable to correction, he would decide if she was okay and let her go. So we could go on and on with thoughts and stories about loving kindness, but I just want to add one more thing. One time a monk was bit by a snake and died, and the Buddha said he failed to do a certain chant of loving kindness towards the snakes. I do not for a moment believe that there is a power in the words of the chant to cause the snakes to not bite. I do believe that chanting with understanding of the meaning of it, building up love in your heart, absolutely has the power to stop a snake from biting, to create some sort of energy or body language or understanding between the beings that the aggression of the snake would not happen or would not have effect. So here we are out in the forest, and there are many beings, and we have to move carefully and reach carefully. I mean, they've even found what do you call those guys? The one special to this region, the funnel web.
Funnels.
Underneath the sponge in the men's wash-up area. Very good for one's mindfulness. Let it also be good for our loving kindness. We have every reason to develop this as a continuing act of mindfulness, continuing practice, day by day, moment by moment, to be pouring out loving-friendly feelings, loving-friendly intentions and feelings. Some people feel it as an emotion. Some people, they just got to like intellectually put the words through their heads. Whatever works. But to keep doing it as much as we can. Okay? Thank you.